God's Whispering Gallery. In the Old House Chamber, the United States Capitol, if you're visiting there, a docent will take you to stand on a brass plaque that's embedded in the floor. That brass plaque is where John Quincy Adams sat after he was president and when he returned to be a member of the House of Representatives. He was an older man. He would sit there where that plaque was, head in his hands, and most of his colleagues thought that he was despondent and discouraged because he wasn't president anymore, was just a congressman. But then the docent will demonstrate something, walk 50 paces away, and in a room full of tourists will whisper, and you can hear the whisper. It's what's called a whispering gallery effect. John Quincy Adams wasn't sad at all. He placed his desk exactly where he could hear his political opponents 50 feet away. And he was listening to every word they say. It is a whispering. It's an effect that takes place where there is a rotunda or a dome that focuses the sound at a given target. Happens in Capitol Building, United States, happens at St. Paul's Cathedral in London and other places, a whispering gallery effect. Now, a physical whispering gallery is an interesting novelty. But a spiritual whispering gallery is sometimes an absolute necessity. In our passage, which was read a moment ago, we read about one of the most noted visits to a spiritual whispering gallery, that made by Elijah the Tishbite. And yet, this stands in one of the greatest contrast of passages in the Old Testament. The highest high in 1 Kings 18, that contest on Carmel, which was the biggest event in the Old Testament holy history since the Exodus itself. In fact, Brevard Childs of Yale makes the statement that all of the odds were with Baal. He got to go first. He got to go longest. He had the most representatives. And then Jehovah handicapped himself. He had to go last. He had one representative. And they soaked the whole thing with water. And yet in that moment, unlike any other moment, that grand theophany of fire, oh, what a moment. I mean, what could you compare it with? I mean, you could look through the annals of preaching history, whether it was Chrysostom preaching at Antioch until even the pagan Roman troops would applaud, or Savonarola holding Florence in his hand for a couple of years, or Paul on the Areopagus, or Massillon preaching to Louis XIV, or Whitfield to 10,000 people, or Billy Graham in the Maracanã Stadium with 250,000 people. Nothing really lines up with what happened that day on Mount Carmel when fire fell. And yet, in the very next chapter, Elijah is dejected, depressed, defeated, marginalized, ready to quit the ministry, and yes, even to walk away from his own life. Strange trip from 1 Kings 18 to 19. If you go over to that piano, it's interesting. On that piano, if you play a C, an E, and a G, it's a bright C major chord, sunshine and all. But if you take that E and move it just one half step, and it becomes an E flat. It becomes a minor key, dolorous, and sad chord. One of the strangest things about ministry is that in any given day of it, we may just be a half step away from 1 Kings 18 and 1 Kings 19. And if you don't know that, just hang around some. in this matter of ministry. Sometimes it's as much as the outward life of a person of God versus the inward life. The public life versus the private life. That miracle on the mountain when fire falls, and that moodiness when you're out under the juniper bush and the shadow grows long. And that's when you have to visit God's whispering gallery. Just a moment, I'll be done. You have to visit that sometimes when you experience brokenness. I'd flown out to Arizona, Tucson, got there late at night. Pastor picked me up, 11th church anniversary, didn't know him, just been invited out there. We talked driving through the desert. How long you been here? 11 years. Or is it one church? Well, no, I came to one, then we started another. Oh, tell me about it. He said, well, I came to the oldest church in the denomination. Great blessing, people being added, gang members being saved, community taking notice. And then they came to me and said, young man, you need to understand something. This isn't God's church, and it's not your church. It's our church. And I said, they didn't really say it that way, did they? And he said, that's exactly what they said. And here was a young man who had moved from 1 Kings 18 to 1 Kings 19 in one unexpected conversation. What are you going to make out of this thing of Elijah running away? Jezebel sent a messenger, Elijah. So let the gods do to me and more if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. Let's just take a look for a moment at the translation of this. On this 400th anniversary of the King James, the Authorized Version, I'm pleased to say that in this instance it got it right where some others got it wrong. The Authorized Version says, when he saw that, ran away. It's interesting, it's a difference in a Hebrew radical, wayar and wayira. The New English Bible, the Jerusalem Bible, the New International Version, the New American Standard Version translated this, he was afraid, and he ran away. For centuries, people have wondered, why would this man who faced down all those Baal prophets in chapter 18 get afraid and run away from a threat from one person in chapter 19. It may just rest in the translation of that word. When he saw that. This is a great prophet. Here's someone whose name is a theophoric name. Jehovah is God. Here was someone whose presence still so loomed over those Galilean hills that when Jesus said, who do people say I am? Some of them said, Elijah. This is no marginal person. Some people try to straighten this out by saying, well, the compiler of 1 Kings got this wrong, and chapter 19 doesn't really belong there. What he did was right-click and cut and paste it in the wrong place. Others say that this is just psychology. When you've had a spiritual high, the counterpoint to that is a spiritual low. Could I just suggest another interpretation? He wasn't afraid. The Authorized Version is right when it says, when he saw that, he just ran away. He had preached his best sermon, prayed his best prayer. Fire fell. He locked up heaven and it didn't rain. He unlocked heaven and it did rain. In fact, chapter 18, it says he even outraced Jehu's chariot back to Jezreel. I don't know if he bought some of this sports drink over here that's two for $3 or a special bar. I don't know. Maybe he watched one of those Jack LaLanne juicer commercials at 3 a.m. in the morning. But he even outraced the chariot back to Jezreel. But when he got back, he thought things would be different. Fire fell. Then rain fell. And he thought Baal was going to fall. And he saw that nothing had changed. This is going back to another era. There was a famous preacher, R.G. Lee, opened a famous sermon on Ahab and Jezebel said, Ahab squatted on the throne of Israel like a toad on a toadstool, and Jezebel coiled beside him like a beautiful adder. That beats saying that they were a bad pair. She was the daughter of Ethbaal, the king priest of Sidon. She had installed Baalism right there in the city of the covenant, the city of David. And Ahab had gone right along with it. But Elijah thought, surely now things will change. But they didn't. I don't think he's afraid. I think when he saw that, he said, I've prayed my best prayer. I've preached my best sermon. I've taken my final stand. And nothing changed. You're only one half step away from 1 Kings 18, 1 Kings 19. It can happen in heroic, tremendous ways and ridiculous ways. It was October 19th, 1856. He was 20 years old. They couldn't find anywhere big enough in London to hold the crowds to hear him preach. The Calvinist Baptists were vilifying. The papers were crucifying him in editorial cartoons. He rented the Surrey Garden Music Hall to preach to the largest crowd who'd ever heard preaching indoors in that city. And seven ruffians from the street entered into a conspiracy and at the same time cried, fire! And in the melee, seven people were trampled to death. 20-year-old Charles Spurgeon was so crushed that he locked himself in a room for 2 weeks, and they didn't think he'd ever preach again. It's only one half step away. Biggest crowd and locked in a room. Sometimes it happens in ridiculous ways. Would you just let me take one of a number of leaves from my life journey? I was pastor at the largest Baptist church in Fort Worth. God was blessing the church. People were being added. We were growing. And same time I was president of the state denomination, it was a blessed time. And then something strange happened. A baby, I don't know what they call them now. We used to call them creepers or crawlers then. They were creeping and crawling on the floor. A baby began biting other babies in the nursery. Well, they brought me word that a baby was biting the babies, so I visited with the preschool minister, a very excellent minister, and we said, well, we're going to have the parents come and watch over this circumstance. Well, they said, we really don't want to leave Sunday school. That's your problem that our baby's biting other babies. Well, so then we said, well, we're going to set up a separate Sunday school, just a Sunday school for the biting baby. Well, they said, our baby's not going to be socialized. You can't do that. Well, it got into the Sunday school department, and I started getting delegations, pro-biting baby delegations and anti-biting baby delegations. Folks were members of the choir. They got the choir divided into the pro- and anti-baby-biting group. And before I knew it, in the middle of all of those good things, I was being consumed with a creeping, crawling, biting baby. Led to a meeting of the officers, and it looked for a day or two as if everything that was happening was going to be sidetracked. Sometimes the strangest things can move you from 1 Kings 18 to 1 Kings 19. Fire falls one day, and you're running out into the desert the next. You need to get to the whispering gallery, not only when there's a situation of brokenness, but sometimes before you get there, you need to just rest. Elijah wasn't ready to hear God yet. He needed to sleep. C.S. Lewis made a statement one time, some of us are more spiritual than God. And what he meant by that is that we forget that we're psychosomatic people, that our psyche affects our soma. And some days in ministry, the best thing you can do for the kingdom of God is just to go home and go to bed. He will not get dizzy and fall off his throne because you take a nap. You know the story. He goes, he runs. He's tired. He's already run 20 miles from Mount Carmel back to Jezreel. Now he runs all the way to Beersheba, which was beyond the hegemony of Ahab. He leaves his mentee there and runs out into the desert to the juniper tree. Can't you see him there, one lonely tree? I mean, at least be encouraging to be in a bunch of trees. One tree. Sun setting, shadow lengthening toward the east. And he goes to sleep. And some kind of theophany takes place. The patristic writers love to call it a Christophany. Somebody shows up with something to eat and something to drink. Angel food cake. He eats it. He sleeps, he eats, he sleeps, and then the strength of that goes for another 40 days. There's something I've had to learn in my ministry, and it's been a hard thing to learn. Did you ever hear the barnyard tragedy of the neurotic rooster? There was a rooster who crowed at sunrise every morning. When the rooster crowed, he noticed that the farmer woke up, the sheep, the cattle, the chickens woke up. Made the rooster have a certain sense of entitlement that everything started because he crowed. But then one day he came to a foul piece of logic. He reversed his crowing and the sun coming up, and instead of thinking he crowed because the sun came up, he thought the sun came up because he crowed. Well, first of all, he became an insomniac rooster. Finally, they had to haul him off to the home for disturbed roosters because he thought that if he didn't crow, the world wouldn't start. When you read what happens to Elijah, what he says two times, that they've torn down your altars, they've killed your prophets, and I'm the only one left, one begins to wonder if he had a sense that the kingdom of God depended on him crowing so the sun could come up. Sometimes you hear sermons so good you want to either steal the title of the sermon or both. Clyde Fant preached a sermon once called Life's Second Greatest Confession. Clyde said the greatest confession was certainly that Caesarea Philippi confession. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. But then he said the second greatest confession is that confession over in Acts when Paul and Barnabas are there at Lystra among the Lyconians. Remember, they wanted to make them gods. And Paul said, we are but humans. And there was something about the drama of Elijah's life, I would think, that finally made him come to face his own humanity, that it's time to eat and sleep and eat and sleep. In that sermon, I had made the statement, you really can't make the greatest confession unless you make the second greatest confession. You're God, and I'm not. And so he ate and slept in the strength of that. I was preaching at Blytheville, Arkansas, 3 or 4 years ago, right by the Mississippi River in one of its big bends, and the pastor took me down to see it. It was flooding, and the county road, it was swallowed by the Mississippi. I'd seen it from a bridge, but I'd never stood eye level with it at flood tide. It was enormously roaring, powerful, consuming. I backed away. Thought about that later on. What if I were to get on a little raft, ride that raft a few miles down, and then beach it on the bank and get off? What kind of deluded fool would I be to say, didn't I make that thing go? No, it made me go. And one of the encouraging things to learn about the history and the reign of God is that we get on our little raft and we ride it for a few years, and we get off, but it was there before us and without us, and it will be there after it and without us. And we don't make it go. It makes us go. And somewhere on the way to Horeb, Elijah had an opportunity to think about that until he got into a conversation with God. Really, you heard it read a moment ago. This is kind of what they call an inclusio. It's bracketed by the same question. What are you doing here, Elijah? That opens it in verse 9. It closes the theophany in verse 13. What are you doing here? That is one of those verses, every word of which is textually interesting. Put the emphasis where you will. What are you doing here? Up to this moment, Elijah's going had always been in Yahweh's sending. He sent him to Ahab. He sent him to the brook. He sends him to the widow's house. He sends him to Shechem. Nobody told him to go there. Let me tell you something I've discovered in ministry. Sometimes when I'm in the middle of a mess that's one of my own making, God says, what are you doing here? I didn't send you there. Or you can put the emphasis on the word you. What are you doing there? You. You've run away. I didn't tell you to run to Horeb. You. Have you got spiritual amnesia? Have you not seen what I've done in your life, taking you from Tishba? Haven't you seen ravens bring you food? Haven't you seen fire fall? What are somebody like you doing there? I saw a sign for Accenture in the airport the other day, one of those backlit advertisements. It says, a goldfish has a memory of 3 seconds. Sometimes I think I have more spiritual amnesia than that. I find myself running from something, and all I have to do is stop and think what God has done. And I don't have to be running off to Horeb. But then the emphasis, what are you doing here? In the Hebrew, it's not that he went to a cave. It's a definite article. It says he went to the cave. Now, what cave could be such a cave in or around Sinai Horeb that it would be called the cave? Might it possibly be that cave, that cleft in a rock where Moses hid? I'm just wondering if Elijah's not reversing the Exodus and saying things sure were better back then. You know, I'm at a certain age of ministry where I fight that more days than not. And that is the idol of nostalgia. If church just was the way it used to be, if we just sang what we used to sing, reversing the Exodus, going back to the cave, maybe to sing Give Me That Old Time Religion. God's direction is never that way. It is always out to that omega point in the future. And God has an agenda for him in that direction. But here we come to the nitty-gritty, the pith, the marrow, where the water hits the wheel. And that's this theophany. Do you ever wonder why this sound and light show? I mean, goodness, he's been through enough, hasn't he? Wind blows and rock shards blow off of Sinai like missiles next to his face. God's not in that. Seismic event under his feet, earth trembles. God's not in that. A fire. I think that means an electric storm. You can almost see him half covering his swarthy face in the mouth of that cave, strobe-like lightning. God's not in there. And then this untranslatable word, you know, only here. Nobody knows what it means. Sound of silence. Everybody's got an idea about this passage. Could I nominate mine? Elijah seemed to build his ministry on the big, the dramatic, the spectacular, fire falling, locking heaven up, unlocking heaven, miraculous meals three times now, ravens bringing food, crews of oil, now angel food cake, all this happening. Maybe He thought this was God's regular modus operandi. We live in a day when the dramatic seems to be seizing ministry. One spectacular Sunday after another. I was up in Kentucky not long ago, sitting around, a bunch of preachers. They were talking about a new ministry at a mega church up there. The first day, the whole staff and the new pastor began the ministry by rappelling down ski ropes from up hidden in the ceiling. What are you going to do next week? I'm in a hotel not long ago, out on the road somewhere preaching, half asleep. Some preacher comes on, looks like a typical Baptist church in the South, you know, lime green carpet, white pulpit, everybody sitting up there on the platform looking, TV service. Well, he gets up and preaches from Isaiah 40, "They that wait on the Lord, mount up with wings as eagles." And when he said that, somebody from somewhere threw a trapeze toward the pulpit. And this man in a suit jumped from behind the pulpit and swinging out over the church said, "Mount up with wings as eagle." I'm sitting there thinking, I'm just not doing this right. I wonder if Elijah had come to think that God's normal MO is the arresting, the dramatic, flashing lightning, roaring thunder. And God didn't want him to know, the way I usually do it is in a still, small voice. Jesus made the statement, the kingdom of God comes without observation. I heard Fred Craddock tell a story one time, and I was so happy. For one time in my life, I thought of the story before he did. I grew up in the Cold War in the 50s, elementary school, west side of Fort Worth. We used to have those duck and cover drills. In case they dropped an atomic bomb on Carswell Airport, we'd be under our desk. And but I came to Jesus at that time. I came, no, I'm not under the desk. No, I mean when I was that age, I came to the Lord. And I had a very dramatic view of the Christian life in the Cold War. I really did. I dreamed that the communists would march down Camp Bowie Boulevard. They'd see Arlen Heights Elementary. They'd come in and line the fourth graders up on the Playlard fence. And they'd say, "Deny Jesus and live." You know, I was looking up and down the line. Of course, I knew all the Episcopalian kids were going to deny him, so that was all right. But there I was. I stepped out. I confessed. They mowed me down right there. Put a little monument there where I fell, you know. It's a funny thing. I thought about that for years, and then I heard Fred say he thought about the same thing. But, you know, he said it so much better than I and anybody ever says it. He said, "I thought I would write one big check." And he said, "Ministry's been 40 years of $1.52, $2.29, 75 cents, preaching one more sermon, holding one more tutorial, grading one more paper." Maybe Elijah needed to learn the lesson that God's MO is not with lightning flashing or thunder roaring. It's in that still small voice and the very next thing that you do. And that's where I want to leave it, because God gave this prophet in the pity party some Nike theology. Just do it. Do you know sometimes the best thing God can do for us when we've rested and heard him is simply give us the next simple thing to do? There's grace in that. But it was a good assignment. He said, "Look, I've got two coronations and one ordination, and you need to get with the program. Retrace your steps. You're not through. Anoint Hazael, king of Damascus, anoint Jehu, and incidentally, ordain your successor. This whole thing doesn't depend on you anyway. And so he retraces his steps from where he really didn't need to be anyway. What are you doing here? Can I leave you with the sum of the matter? We are not in any position ever to really evaluate what God has yet for us to do. When he thought he was finished, coronations, ordinations, when he thought he was finished, did he ever make an exit? Why? He left in an exit that was so remarkable, they named it for a movie, Chariots of Fire. No, I mean, they named the movie for that. And then that cameo appearance, all those centuries later, when he and that other titan stand by Jesus on the Mountain of Transfiguration. This whispers to me that none of us are ever in a position to know what God might do next. I can tell you this. If I look back in the rearview mirror of my own life, there were moments not all that long ago when I didn't have a clue what he was about to do next. And that's why sometimes you need to go to God's whispering gallery.